This program is sponsored by Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts. Located at 185 Worcester Street, right on Route 9, they can be reached at 508-545-8105 or at wickedchronicvendorcommerce.com. Wicked Chronic is a boutique-style retail shop that focuses on selling counterculture products such as Wiccan, cannabis cultures coming together in a unique setting. You need something for that special spell? Go on down to Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts and speak to Beverly. Tell them Dr. Chris sent you. Check them out today. And you are listening to the Dead TV Podcast, a podcast dedicated to canceled television shows in the horror, science fiction, and fantasy genre. And happy Friday the 13th to everyone listening to the first episode covering the Friday the 13th television series. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, Mistress Zeneca.
Hello, everyone.
As well as a once-in-a-while collaborator for our journey through Friday the 13th, the TV series, or Friday's Curse, or Curious Goods. We don't know what title of the show we will go with yet, but the writer of Curious Goods, behind the scenes of Friday the 13th, the series, as well as a writer in the horror genre for many things like the Sci-Fi Channel and FearNet, we have Elise Wax on the show with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for writing this amazing book that is a insane detailed guide to Friday the 13th, the TV series, which has nothing to do with Jason Voorhees, as our dear friend Crazy Ralph will say right here in this clip.
You're going to Camp Blood, ain't you?
God damn it, Ralph, get out of here. Go on, get. Leave people alone.
You'll never come back again.
Oh, shut up, Ralph.
It's got a death curse.
But we don't have a death curse. Do we?
No.
I guess we do, considering all the objects in this are cursed by the devil, Lucifer, El Diablo.
Yes.
Yes.
Starting us off with the first episode, right?
Yes.
The first episode. The Inheritance originally aired on September 28th, 1987. Two cousins, Ryan DeLeon and Mickey Foster, inherit an antique shop from their uncle. Together with his brother, they must track down cursed objects that their devil-worshipping uncle had created. The first object is a demonic killer porcelain doll.
In 1987, I was 7 years old and just starting, I want to say, the third grade, maybe? I know it was at Fox Chapel Elementary School in Germantown, Maryland. I know exactly where it was if I don't remember the exact grade. But I was introduced to this TV series having watched the show that came before it, Star Trek The Next Generation, which was also a Paramount show that Paramount decided, hey, we got these two properties, let's make television shows about them. Star Trek had been laying dormant for a while, except for in cinema. Cinema, movie theaters, Star Trek was kicking ass and taking names. I caught wind of it later on the Sci-Fi Channel as I got older, as I was not allowed to stay up past Star Trek The Next Generation to watch Friday the 13th, the TV series. How were you introduced to it, Elise?
I was introduced to it, actually, it was probably closer to 1990, and looking back, I think it was towards the very end of the original run of the show, of the live run, as it were. It was, interestingly enough, in Los Angeles, which is where I grew up, it played at 10 a.m. on Saturday mornings, which seems a very out-of-place time for a horror show to air. And I was flipping channels looking for something because cartoons had ended and, you know, there wasn't anything else on. So I was flipping channels and I came across this scene. It was Stick It In Your Ear, which was a late third season episode. And there was just all of this gore and grew and disgusting stuff all over the TV. And I was totally enamored by it. and that was it. The obsession began right there.
So I think, Elise, you and I watched the same broadcast because I was also in California, Los Angeles, and I think that's pretty much where I stepped into it as well. I think I caught season three, but what really caught my attention was the opening segment. You know, when you're kind of, the camera pans through the store and then it goes to the crystal glass with something in it and the show's titles came out. That really grabbed me. So when I consecutively, or I should say later, when I got introduced to Tales from the Crypt and it takes that same type of journey through his little castle fortress, it reminded me so much of Friday the 13th, the series, that I ended up seeking it out when it became on syndication later.
Ah, yeah.
Now, the first episode was directed by William Fruitt and written by Bill Taub, if I'm pronouncing those correctly, or Bill Taub. And William Fruitt would work on Goosebumps, My Secret Identity, which was our introduction, if you were not watching Stand By Me, to Jerry O'Connell. The Zach Files, Poltergeist Legacy, which my roommate just got in the mail this weekend. It was sitting on the dining room table, and I was like, oh, Poltergeist Legacy, I loved that show. The Outer Limits, and of course, several episodes of Friday's Curse that we will get to, so we will see his name. And then Bill also worked on several episodes of Friday's Curse, as well as a show called Relic Hunter in China, which worked around at the same time, involving scantily clad warrior women in the jungle.
Yes, Bill was actually also the, I believe it was story editor for the first season, maybe a little bit of the second season, but yeah, so he was around all the time.
Zeneca, why don't you start us with the episode plot line and as it unfolds, and we will jump in.
Scene opens up, a rainy day, and this family seeks refuge inside the antique store. So it's obvious that the gentleman that runs the store, Lewis, doesn't really want them there, but the door is set open, so he's just kind of reluctantly allowing them to browse the objects. The daughter, the tiny daughter, is told not to touch anything, and of course, what does she do? The first thing she does is touch a top and a jack-in-the-box. And Lewis is getting nervous because I think every single object in there is cursed. So, you know, something is bound to happen. And she ends up looking at the porcelain doll. So we're introduced to the father character and then the stepmother. So the three characters.
With the biggest shoulder pads of the 1980s.
Oh, huge. Huge.
Yes. And it's also, it's worth noting that Sarah Polley played the daughter, Mary, who went on to be in The Sweet Hereafter, and totally blanking on a whole bunch of her
Splice,
stuff.
Monster sci-fi movie about her and Adrian Brody create the super sexy alien.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Splice.
Yes. It goes from being this cute little, like, family movie to this very sexy naked alien movie to this horrible, horrible rape film. As he has sex with her, and then the thing grows a penis and then rapes Sarah Polley, impregnating her with its splice baby.
Oh my God.
Wow. Yes.
Horrifying. And she was also in the remake of Dawn of the Dead.
Yes, starring Zack Snyder, best known as the director of the worst Superman movies ever.
Yes.
We then get the family shootout after Mary takes the doll and kills somebody, which, by the way, through the entire episode, never once do we see a headline. In fact, in the next 71 episodes, and Elise, you could probably say something about this, do we ever see a headline about a little girl and a doll murdering a man in a garage?
No.
No, okay.
Fair. I mean, nobody knows that it was the doll. They just found the guy dead. So,
well, I mean, there was two people there, and the doll only slashed one of them, so there was one witness.
Yeah, so the doll...
Yeah, but nobody's going to believe that.
Oh, that's true.
True, but this is the 80s. I mean, we've had plenty of killer dolls. We've had Stuart Gordon's dolls. We've had Chucky. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
So the Uncle Lewis shoos the family away, and then he gets a surprise visitor from the Invisible Devil.
And I actually have a tidbit on that, because you know how I am with demonic symbology. It's my bag, baby. The symbol that actually lights up in flames just before Lewis is killed it looks like a triangle with three circles and kind of an X underneath it and some crosses. That's actually the Goetic Circle of Pacts. And so that was created in the 19th century, and it's used to make a pact with the descending hierarchy, so the demons, devils of the lower echelon. In fact, I found the actual spell for this to create a pact. Don't ask me how I got it. The three circles are basically the places where the sorcerer and the two apprentices stand in. So this would be written on the ground. On one side, on the upper right side of the triangle, would be the skull of your parent, or a parent, of one of the three people. And that person had to be killed by one of those people in the spell. So it's parasite, pure parasite. Mm-hmm. The lower quadrant corner, that would be the horns of a goat. The next quadrant, which is the right lower quadrant, would be a black cat that has eaten human flesh. So basically like the body of a black cat.
Yummy.
Doesn't have to be living. And then the upper quadrant on the left side of the triangle would be a bat that has been drowned in blood.
Oh.
All of these combined with some special words or whatnot, you could make your own pact with the devil.
You know, there's a Hammer film where Dracula is resurrected and blood is poured on a bat. Now, there wasn't not real blood poured on this live, living creature, but it was like a food-colored water that was being poured on a living bat in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if you were to actually do this spell, well, for one, I mean, you're killing one of your parents, you know, but the ingredients are actually a bit uncommon to do. You'd have to have a black cat that has eaten human flesh, so you could reasonably cut off a part of yourself to feed it. The bat has to be drowned in blood, and if you cut off a piece of yourself, you would have a significant amount of blood. But if you killed your parent, there would also be a significant amount of blood to drown the bat in. And then the horns of a goat, which is just actually the easiest part of the entire ceremony.
After the devil after the devil shows up with some bad CGI, we're introduced to Roby, like Madonna, who plays one of our three main characters, Mickey. Now, I've actually had Louise Roby on the show. I had her on the show in 2008. And after she came on the show, she wasn't that hard to get a hold of, which I was always surprised by the Friday the 13th documentary people, the Crystal Lake Chronicles that came out a few years ago. They said they were not able to reach her, but I stayed in very good contact with her for a while, but I haven't over the last several years. But after she came on the show, she invited me up to her villa with her and her husband in France.
Ooh.
Yes.
And did you go?
No, I never went. This is the second time I've been invited to France by a guest that came on the show. But the thing I want to point out about her husband, though, Lloyd, who's played by Barclay Hope, he is currently, or was, on a television series which just ended its first season, playing Cliff Blossom, the father of Cheryl Blossom, on Riverdale, the Archie series.
Yep.
And actually, it wasn't her husband in the show. It was her fiancé.
Yeah, that's right. They did not get married yet. But then she runs over to she flies out to, by the way, there's never a location for where this place, this store is, correct?
Correct, although there is one episode, I believe it may have been Baron's Bride, no. There was an episode where somebody asks Ryan where he's from, and he says Chicago.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if this is meant to be like this is where the store is set. When I spoke to the various producers and writers, it was always just kind of like a generic American town.
Okay. Yeah, that's what it seems like. So. But there's definitely a lot of Canadian landmarks, correct?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. And now that you're in Canada right now, you should like be like on your free time, like running around trying to find out, ooh, where's the Friday the 13th landmarks? I should take pictures.
Well, it's on the other coast. So
okay.
Nearby.
Oh, okay.
Last
I got
time
you.
I was in Toronto. I did attempt to do that.
Ryan the Lion is introduced, played by John D. LeMay, who's Mickey's cousin and the other half of the inheritance for this store, after she nearly kills him with a vase over the head when he surprises her. John D. LeMay is the only connection to this show to the movie franchise, as he would go on to appear in Jason Goes to Hell, The Final Friday, as Jason's nephew, in a way? Jason's sister, played by Erin Gray, has a daughter, and John D. LeMay plays the ex-husband of the daughter, and they have a child together, Jessica. So he becomes kind of the hero of the film, and again, the only actor to actually appear in both of these franchises, if you want to call them that.
Yes.
the Friday the 13th universe, if you could call it. So
the universe.
Ryan finds the Iron Maiden.
Put them in the Iron Maiden.
Iron Maiden? Excellent!
Execute them. Bogus.
All right, and that was a clip from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Okay, this is one thing I don't understand. So the store is in probate, and they were wanted by default. Now, what does that mean?
I think what it means is that he didn't have an executor of an estate listed. It was sent to basically the courts to divvy out the estate properties and funds. So that would be, I think that's what probate means.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm not really a legal person.
Yeah, basically that's what it means. It was divvied up, and, you know, like he says, they won it by default.
Only relatives.
Yeah, the whole relative thing is very strange, because it was never really established how they're all related.
Yeah, because in later episodes, Ryan starts, like, getting interested in Mickey and wanting to date her, right?
No! No, that's gross.
Yeah,
no,
but it was it's kind of implied that way in some way.
You know, the second episode that we're reviewing, you know, the Poison Pen, he does make a lot of references to basically just, you know, being flirtatious with her. It's kind of inappropriate.
I prefer to see it. Maybe I'm seeing it through the innocence of a child who originally saw it, but I prefer to think of it as just more of like a friendly, you know, familial kind of thing. I don't want to think about them hooking up. That's gross.
It is gross, but...
It is gross, yeah.
I can't not comment on what's actually in the show.
I know.
But
I mean,
we'll get there. We'll get there.
The reason that they were made cousins was to prevent it. They didn't want to have to deal with the whole, like with moonlighting, you know, the will they or won't they.
Yeah.
So in order to cut that out, they just made them related so that it wasn't even an option.
Moonlighting, Castle, The X-Files, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. Yeah, they all basically fell into that. So they get this awesome car and they decide to go for a ride in it. And then a black cat jumps out and scares Roby just for a quick little jump scare, because I guess there was nothing happening in the episode up to this point, because we weren't getting back to the killer doll plot line anytime soon. Uncle Lewis recorded everything in a journal. And the couple comes back for Vita. Is that how you pronounce it, Elise?
Yeah.
Okay. Vita gets taken by the couple, and next thing you know, the cousins are selling everything in the store, and that's where we meet our third and final character, my favorite character of the whole show, Jack, as played by Chris Wiggins.
Yes. He's just great in the show.
He's amazing.
He's the true constant, I think, throughout the show. Like, Roby's character gets better as we go on. John DeLemay's Ryan character, I think, gets somewhat better. Like, they have, like, evolving character arcs to make their characters better. John's doesn't kind of live out that long as Roby's, but Jack's always is consistent, I think, in every single episode.
Right. Well, you know, he was kind of the patriarch of the show. I mean, both Louise Roby and John LeMay were both relatively new-ish actors. You know, they hadn't been doing it for terribly long. And, you know, Chris was seasoned. He had been acting for probably as long as the two of them had been alive.
And do you know what Chris actually did for the voice acting of for several different things for a long time, going all the way back to the 1950s? He was in Babar. Mm-hmm. He was Cornelius in Babar. He was an Avenger one time in Hawkeye, The Last of the Mohicans. No, I'm kidding. he was also on a show that we just got done talking about in the last episode of the Dead TV podcast. He was on Droids, the Star Wars show.
Wow.
He was also the voice of the Spider-Man villain Mysterio, who appeared as a bowl-wearing, green tunic-looking Spider-Man villain, has been around since the 60s. The Care Bears cartoon series, and he was the narrator of several of the Sailor Moon movies. Guy's got some range.
Yeah.
So once
you know what I loved about the reveal of the journal of the accounting of all of the cursed objects is the way that trap door opened in the ceiling. You know, the turn of the slat. Like, that's brilliant, because usually it's like a candle on the wall or a book you pull, And this is a turn of a slat. I'm like, oh my god, that's brilliant. If I ever have a house with lots of hidden passages, that will be one of the ways you get in.
Yeah, that's very brilliant. If anyone remembers the old Batman TV series, they would flip open the head of Thomas Jefferson and turn a dial. You could actually buy that at one point. They mass-produced those to wire into any electronical device. So if you had your own secret packet, your own secret passageway, you could wire it into that so you could flip open the head of Thomas Jefferson and turn the device to open your secret passage.
Awesome.
So the one thing I gotta ask you, when you were researching the TV series and writing this book, did you ever think to yourself, okay, so all these objects were sold pretty much at the same time by the cousins, or over the past several years by the Uncle Lewis or whatever, shouldn't there be like countless murders and despicable, terrible things happening to people, and they're just playing catch up trying to capture these?
Well,
the body count should be huge by the time they get to episode 72.
Well, but here's the thing, though, is that not every owner is going to use it maliciously. I mean, you have to kind of consent to give in to the evil. So if you're not an evil person, you wouldn't start thinking, or if you don't have any sort of malice in your heart, you're not going to start going around killing people. That said, it's one of those things that I feel with a show like this, you kind of have to go in with like a few grains of salt. And it's like, it's a show about items cursed by the devil. You know, you can't expect the whole thing to make sense.
Now, there was something that Roby pointed out to me when I asked her, what was your favorite thing about the working on the set? What was your least favorite thing? And she was always like, my cast. I always loved my cast. That was always the perfect thing. The extras we had were great. She said that the worst thing that she hated about it sometimes was temperature control on that set was ridiculous. And
yeah.
In this episode, it is more prominently shown on her shirt than any other that I knew what she was talking about when she said that to me.
Yeah, you could definitely see her nipples.
Yes, it reminded me of Friends, as it was constantly pointed out and made fun of on Friends that Monica and Rachel's characters were constantly braless because the set must have been freezing cold because they were always poking through their shirts. And it was just like, didn't anyone figure out how to digitally edit stuff out? Not in a 1980s TV series, but you think on an NBC sitcom with a multi-million dollar budget like Friends, they would have.
You know, I think they're just pumping out those episodes. They weren't really paying attention. Or they purposefully left them in just to capture a little bit more of the male demographic.
Oh, I definitely guarantee it was that. In fact, I remember Courtney Cox even joking about that years later, saying that that was like the best recognition that she had was that her, you know, just... And again, I remember Roby talking to me about that, saying that sometimes it was really cold on set, sometimes you could see your own breath. And I was like, oh, okay. And then rewatching these episodes, I'm like, oh.
Oh, yeah. Every single person I interviewed for the book said that that was the one thing that was really horrible about it, was that it was always cold because they shot out on location for a lot of it. And, you know, up in Toronto, and they were shooting nights, and it would be negative, you know, dip below zero, and it was cold. One of the crew guys told me a story about somebody who was joking around and put his tongue on like a flashlight
or something.
Oh
and
no!
Lost a chunk of his tongue because it froze to it.
Like the kid in the Christmas story.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so we switch back over to the uptight, rich, white, yuppie family, basically a poster child for the 1980s, where the stepmom, who's a little bit overbearing, and the father pretty much just lets the stepmom be overbearing, but also buys the daughter whatever he wants. It's not a very well-managed household. Is getting a little tired of her stepdaughter's attitude and decides to lock up the doll in the closet, where she's like, watch that tone of voice, and I'm like trying to figure out, what tone of voice did she use? She just wanted to play and didn't really. I didn't think that
was
very well
written. She talked back. She talked back and was like, "Well, you're going to do this. You're going to clean up your room or whatnot." And she's like, "No, I'm doing a tea party right now." And so that type of instant disobedience, like, "No, what I'm doing is more important than what you, the stepmother, is telling me to do." The stepmother took great offense with that.
True.
Yeah, it's a not very well blended family because the stepmother doesn't like that she has to fight with Mary for, you know, her husband's attention, and in general she doesn't really enjoy being a mother.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially to someone who's not her kin.
When she...
And also later in the show, he explains that he pretty much got together with his stepmother shortly after the death of his former wife.
Yeah.
So this was like a rebound girl that just kind of filled in the spot for mother. And I think that's also something that the stepmother is, upset over. You know, she doesn't really feel like this is truly her place. And so she's trying to exert control in order to make it her place.
Now, when they lock, I almost said Annabelle in the closet, but when they locked Vita in the closet, it reminds me of Annabelle being locked in the closet in Annabelle Creations, the prequel to Annabelle, which came out in theaters a couple months ago.
Yeah.
The doll has psychic powers. All dolls seem to have psychic powers, except for Chucky. He never really displayed psychic powers. He just happens to have some gooey innards inside him. But the dolls and dolls, the Puppet Master dolls, they all seem to have psychic powers. Before this, by the way, one thing I completely skipped over is that when they're going over the details about what Uncle Lewis did and his deal with devil worshipping, it's Ryan that knows a little bit about devil worshipping, and Roby's like, how do you know about that?
He learned it from comic books.
I love that. I absolutely love that, because I am a huge comic book fan. Mr. Zeneca is a comic book fan. I am a ginormous comic book fan. I have a copy of Werewolf by Night sitting right here next to me as we're recording this, The Omnibus, which is 1,000 pages of Werewolf by Night comic books. And if you've ever read Werewolf by Night, even talking to our listeners, this comic book series had a lot to do with like devil worshipping and black magic and voodoo and stuff like that, because of the curse of the werewolf upon our character in the story. And this is a comic book you could kill somebody with. It's that thick. 1,000 pages of comic book artwork. Did you happen to notice, at least, that Ryan's clothes are 3 times too big for him in almost every episode of the show?
Yeah.
Okay, what the fuck?
It started off because he was, you know, supposed to be kind of dorky and a little bit just, you know, kind of that weird kid in the corner kind of thing.
Is that why he wears a suit with cargo shorts?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, as the show goes on, he kind of grows up a little bit, and so does his wardrobe.
Now we go into our favorite part of the episode, where we talk about the MacGuffin of the episode happens to be a porcelain doll. And something I thought we would do a little bit differently for this, Mr. Zeneca, is actually maybe talk about if we happen to actually own, between maybe the three of us for this episode, if either one of us happened to own a porcelain doll like the one that Mary has. I myself did not, but did either one of you as little girls?
I actually, my mom would make porcelain dolls. Yeah, they were only about 12 to 18 inches tall, did not have any moving parts like this one. So she would cast and pour the head, hands, and feet of the porcelain dolls herself.
Oh, okay.
And it was like one of her little hobbies. She would sew the body and then create the pieces, and each one of them had a name that she would write on the back side of the headpiece.
Oh.
And she would give them away as gifts, and I still have one, and I use it as my Christmas tree topper every year.
Oh, well, I'm never coming over to your house for Christmas, so...
No, I swear, it's not creepy looking.
Right, yeah, sure, whatever. Okay, whatever you happen to say. Yeah, never ever going to your house for Christmas, but you definitely should watch Annabelle Creations, because the beginning of the opening of the movie is the Annabelle doll being put together.
If my mother was actually into the occult like I am, I might have some concerns. Yeah, she completely is... vanilla and non-spiritual as you come, so...
Okay, just do us a favor. If you happen to die a violent and horrible death in the future, don't let that doll anywhere near you when you die because of all the weird, witchy, mumbo-jumbo stuff that you're in. That
I will
doll,
put my soul into the doll like Chucky.
Fuck you. No way. And then next thing you know, it's mailed to me, and he's like, I'll get him! As she twirls her mustache.
and then you can hear my little porcelain feet, you know, clinking on the wooden floors.
I'm sorry, I'm about 5'8". I will take that doll and throw it right into the goddamn fire. Did you say you had one or not, Elise?
No, I was never really a play with dolls kind of kid.
Okay, so, all right. You were more into action figures. That's what I like to call my dolls. With kung fu grip.
I never played with dolls. I will say I had Barbies when I was little, because I think all little girls have Barbies. And by the time I was about 8 or 9 or so, my Barbie and Ken would get married on the roof of their dream house. And then as soon as they said I do, Barbie would throw Ken off the roof and collect his insurance money.
Oh, nice. My God.
Yeah.
Well, anyone listening to this, that might have been, you know, I wouldn't put that on, your husband's okay, right? Your boyfriend? I mean, do we need to be worried about anybody in your life? Maybe send them a warning, maybe this recording, be like, you should listen to this before.
Oh, he knows.
Okay, we just want to make sure.
Yeah.
This is dismissible in court, so. So the stepmom is killed. We're just gonna kind of like get right to that. She is basically killed off by the doll. She's in the hospital, and then the doll like sucks the life force out of her. So mission accomplished for the doll. What's funny though is they say obviously every one of these objects is cursed. What type of curse was placed on the doll to make it like Chucky or Annabelle? I mean, what type of personality is it? Is it just a demon? Is it like in Annabelle where it's a demon that took possession? It's never explained, ever.
I think that the demon, you know, the devil has kind of cursed all of these objects. I don't think it was necessarily that, like, he put a spirit inside of Vita.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the pact was just for basically the ability to curse objects. So he got that ability to curse objects to pay for his immortality, and so there wasn't a specific demon, it's just that this object and then its usage probably by the intent put into it, and that's what it became. So I think when he does an object, it was more like a grab bag of what it could do.
Okay.
And then someone finds out what it could do, and then he was collecting the newspaper clippings to find out how someone was killed because of it.
It's true that the curses could change depending on who was using it, as we saw with the compact.
Yes, later on. The doll makes this hissy sound, which I thought was always kind of cool. Its signature-like move. I wonder if that's the part that actually scares Channing Tatum, because you say in the back of the chapter of in your book that Channing Tatum cited this doll on the Ellen show as being the reason why he's afraid of dolls?
Yes.
Okay.
It was quite hilarious.
I will definitely have
to... And then, of course, Ellen has to be all mean and present a whole bunch of porcelain dolls to scare him.
All right. I will have to look that episode on YouTube after we get done recording, because I have not had a chance to watch it yet, but this would be the perfect night to do so. the poor old babysitter is left in charge of babysitting the new queen bee in the house, Mary... having taken over from her stepmother. And I love how Vita's powers are basically godlike, as she can control the weather as well.
Yeah. And reset bookcases and take away any sort of evidence that anything was wrong. So, yeah, her powers definitely grew as long as the child was using her.
Correct. And once they separated her from the doll, she was pretty much back to being a normal little girl with some severe emotional problems that a good therapist will fix her up in about 20 years.
20 years, yeah.
Once they wrap up the case with the doll, Roby's back on the phone with her fiancé, Lloyd, and he's basically back to being kind of a dickhole.
I think that's not a very good relationship right there from the start. Even from the first conversation that you see with him, it's just not a good relationship.
Yeah, and, you know, Mickey was a different person at the start of this show. She was definitely a lot closer in kind to Lloyd than she was as the Mickey that we knew her as, you know, towards the middle and the end of the series. You know, she was very kind of spoiled and kind of a yuppie.
Yeah.
Every single episode during the credit sequence will have the picture of the item in question that is cursed, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I love the music. The music is done by Fred Mullen. Is that correct, Elise?
Yeah, Mullen.
Mullen, okay. And you can find the soundtrack to the show on CD and recently re-released on LP.
Oh, I didn't know it was on LP.
Yeah, it's very inexpensive. I think it's like a $15 or $20 LP. The CD is like $10 or $15, and then you can download all the entire soundtrack on iTunes.
Yeah.
Not every episode has its own theme, but there's like 15 to 20 tracks, so it's pretty good, and I really did enjoy the soundtrack. It's very befitting of the show. Roby, when she came on Radio of Horror, heavily promoted it, as well as her own CD. And a lot of people don't know this, is that Roby herself is a huge musician, and very popular in Europe, especially in France. Do we ever get to see her sing on the show in the 72 episodes?
Not on the show, but one of her songs is used in the episode with the sheriff's badge of honor.
Okay.
In the club scene.
Gotcha. Well, again, we appreciate you coming on for at least the first episode, The Inheritance, with us. If you'd like to stick around for The Poison Pen, that'd be fine as well. We're about to just start talking about it right now. Like I said, we'd love to have you on the show at least once a month to talk about, you know, an episode here or there. I can send you ahead of time what episodes that we're going to be covering and recording, and then just pick that you're available to come on the show with us within your schedule, of course.
I always love talking about Friday the 13th, the series. I never get tired of it.
Awesome.
Well, thank you guys so much. This was really fun.
No problem.
Oh, thanks so much.
All right, so the second episode is The Poison Pen, which Mr. Zeneca has the episode synopsis for.
All right, The Poison Pen originally aired October 5th, 1987. Ryan and Mickey disguise themselves as monks to retrieve a mysterious pen kept in an ancient monastery. Now, the episode revolves around this monastery which holds the Eternal Brotherhood.
Yeah, and by the way, I wanted to point out that IMDb lists the show as Friday's Curse, which is what they called it in Canada, because they didn't want to call it Friday the 13th, which is what we should have done. But there was a whole bait and switch about why that was done that way.
Yeah, it really has nothing to do with the Friday the 13th, the franchise thing.
No,
so,
other than,
I mean, yeah, other than the name, it shares the name. That's about it.
Yeah, and again, as we stated earlier, other than John D. LeMay is the only connection between the two, as him playing the main hero character in Jason Goes to Hell. By the way, I wanted to point out that the writer of this episode, he is the writer, has worked on War of the Worlds, She-Ra, Prince of Power, The Real Ghostbusters, Dino Saucers, again, that cartoon I told you to check out, and Queen of Swords, which was a 2000 fantasy television show that was not that great. And Timothy Bond, no relation to Timothy Dalton, who played James Bond for the episode, and also worked on My Secret Identity, as well as the Goosebumps television series and Hercules the Legendary Journey.
Interesting. Yes.
As well as Time Cop, RoboCop, Outer Limits, War of the Worlds, and he also worked on Alfred Hitchcock's Presents.
Ooh, I love that show.
Yes, that was a really great show. So the monks meet to discuss money, and they're thinking about selling the monastery, which we find out later on in the episode is going to be used to, they're going to tear down the monastery and build luxury
condominiums.
Yes. How about you don't tear down the monastery if you're buying it, and you turn the monastery into luxury condominiums? Like, people would live in a castle like that.
You know, out here in Philadelphia, we actually do have several old-style churches that have been changed into apartments. And a couple friends of mine actually rented one of those. It was pretty cool. Like, you could travel up these little pathways to get to the kind of footpath on the roof and overlook the entire, you know, church itself. It's pretty cool. You know, it's something to do with these churches that don't really have the patronship to continue running. And I don't know how the real estate market goes for monasteries. Wouldn't the money raised from a monastery sale go to the church itself?
Yeah, but I don't think this is the Catholic Church, though. Catholic churches don't have monks, do they?
Monks definitely are part of the Christian religion. It's just a section. You know, it's like an offshoot. There's, you know, lots and lots of offshoots of Christianity. So this Eternal Brotherhood, I'm not sure would have been, you know, I don't think the head monk would be able to get the amount of money. It would have just been put into an estate or distributed amongst the monks. But also, monks typically take a vow of poverty. I don't know how this legal transaction would have really taken place.
The quill, the pen, the quill of the pen was made from a Chilean condor. Apparently, they are the worst type of condors. Here in Massachusetts, we actually have turkey vultures, which, if you've ever seen a turkey vulture before, it has the head of a turkey but the body of a vulture. They're ugly creatures. And I couldn't find in Elisa's book, Curious Goods, Behind the Scenes of Friday the 13th, where this was filmed and what monastery this was. Is it set during the credits at the end of the episode?
I did not notice the location.
Okay, so we'll just kind of skip right past that then. They get the newspaper that there was a death, and they decide to investigate. Jack points out that Nostradamus and other predictions that Roby's character Mickey does not happen to believe in these type of predictions. And they decide they have to go undercover, but Mickey can't go because it's a monastery for monks, not a convent
yes.
for nuns. And she's like, sexism in 1987? And I'm like, oh, yes, don't worry. In 2017, sexism has been completely abolished. I mean, look at our great president and all hero women.
Yeah. this oracle of death that is predicting all of these deaths, but using the quill, so in fact creating all of these deaths, you know, the parallels between Nostradamus and this is pretty weak. You know, Nostradamus did predictions. It is debatable whether any of them actually came true.
True.
You know, there are some coincidences, some similarities, but really, I think most of his predictions stopped, I don't know, like 100 years ago, something like that. So people still today, like the conspiracy theorists, will say, oh, Nostradamus, Nostradamus, as if he is the end-all, be-all of prediction. And that is just not true. Like,
now,
if you were to really read his predictions, they are so vague. They're like horoscopes. They could apply to any day, any person.
Now, when the monk goes flying, did it remind you of Sally Field, the Flying Nun?
But a little bit, yeah. You Facebook messaged me that. Just kind of rising up and, you know, floating about for a little bit.
Now, as a woman, and I can't ever figure these out sometimes. I mean, I'm not a great judge of the size of a woman's breast. But being a woman and having breasts yourself, what size would you say Roby's breasts are, and how hard would it be to tape them down like they do in this episode?
Well, I think based on her boobage in the last episode, I would say she's probably about a B cup to maybe a light C cup.
Really?
And
that small, you think?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Again,
yeah.
You're a better expert than me. All I am an expert on is...
She's got a nice handful, but it doesn't overflow like a D cup.
Okay. So you think they'd be easy to tape down like the way they do?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
Because they probably only tape them down for that one scene, and then when she's wearing the robe, she's probably not taped down.
No, because I was specifically looking at that detail and how she was successfully passing as a male, and she totally wasn't.
No. I mean, she has such feminine features in her face.
Yeah, and just the fact that she did not even go through the effort of wearing a wig to cover her long hair.
Yeah.
It's just kind of pulled back. That's kind of questionable. And then she's wearing the robes, and you can totally see that there are peaks and valleys in the front of her robe.
So she was not
tied down for, you know, bound down for the entirety of the episode.
And she absolutely loves the idea of a communal shower, of course.
You know, and in that scene, her cousin actually says, quote, one can hope about the communal showers. And I was like, really? That's your cousin?
Yeah, that's why I was like, maybe Elise doesn't want to, you know, is suspending disbelief about that. And it's, I admit, it is a little weird once in a while, but how really much of cousins are they? Because they don't even know each other.
They don't know each other. They've never met. They never met their uncle. It doesn't seem like they're distant cousins. You know, they're direct cousins.
I think so. I don't think they're first cousins, though.
I want to say, like, if it was their uncle, they didn't call him ever great uncle, so it would have been the uncle's brother or sister's children,
maybe,
I think.
Maybe. So we got the ominous dinner as they decide to bring the guy, the monk who can predict the stuff, his dinner. What is the monk's name? He is Father...
Frank is his real name, but Curry? Yes. Is it Curry?
Yes, Brother Curry. Brother Curry. They're called brothers. I forgot. They're not called friars or fathers. They're Brother Curry, and you have the ominous music playing during it. And I love how they're passing by those medieval torture devices from a Saw film. What the fuck are they doing in a monastery?
Well, those are just leftovers from the Inquisition.
Oh, right. And the Inquisition was how long ago? This is Night 7.
And in the basement of the Vatican, I'm sure you can get all sorts of manner of medieval torture devices and
right,
you know, scrolls that have been locked away for centuries.
Right, along with the scrolls written by Jesus Christ.
Yeah, time does not really matter when it comes to religious places. It's like something can be stuck into a religious place and be forgotten about for 100 years, and that's kind of common.
Now, Roby also needs to take a vow of silence in order to protect her voice because she does not sound like a man. Of course, the our brother Nostradamus is what I'm going to call him from now on. Also has taken a vow of silence. How fortunate!
I'm not sure if it was the background characters that needed working on, but she's breaking her vow of silence within earshot of other monks.
A little bit, yeah, and they can completely hear her. Then, of course, that guy is named the new Abydos, and he's going to die, and then the bed makes a good impression on him. Get it?
See what you did there. So he's being pressed, you know, and his, according to the Oracle of Death, he is supposed to be choked. Instead, he's being pressed by this bed because he breaks through the little screen that makes a part of the upper canopy of the bed and sticks his head out. So therefore, he is breathing, but maybe the weight of the canopy on him, it chokes him in some way, suffocating him, I guess. But he looked quite pleasant, like he had died in his sleep when they get back to him.
The guy who plays the D-bag head monk, played by Colin Fox, and again, another one of those TV actors who's in, like, some of the... He's in so much syndicated stuff. It's unbelievable. It just keeps going on and on and on the more I look at IMDb. I love the fact that he was on Wildcats, which was a cartoon series that was based on a comic book by Jim Lee, one of the creators of founders of Image Comics. He was in Goosebumps. He was in Rupert. He was in Shirley Holmes, which if I remember from the 90s was a TV series about the daughter of Sherlock Holmes.
Beetlejuice,
the animated series, and again, another actor that was in The Legend of Zelda, the cartoon series. He was the king. He was Zelda's father, actually.
Oh, man, yeah. I was watching this episode with my boyfriend, and he was like, oh, my God, I know him. Where is he from? And so we had to look him up. So, yeah, he's just in everything.
After Roby continues whining about the store and the cursed objects and everything else, Jack sneaks into the monastery to become a monk himself and to help out the cousins.
He is supposedly a transfer from Ireland, and he actually does a very good Irish accent. You know, he's completely believable.
He's otherworldly. He definitely needs to be.
Yeah, and he's, you know, brings in the duplicate pen to kind of trade out with the cursed quilled pen. All along in the process, they're being followed because they're suspected of being, like, journalists, but he's not suspected because he has a stunning Irish accent, and no one really suspects him of anything.
That reminds me of a great line from Robin Hood Men in Tights, when Cary Elwes says to the king, he says, "And why the hell should the people listen to you? Unlike other Robin Hoods, I actually speak with an English accent." Ooh. Now, I called him Brother Nostradamus, but I completely forgot he's actually called the Oracle of Death. So that is actually the nickname used. Ryan and Roby continue to investigate. An unforeseen force compels the monk to be killed by a guillotine that he's forcing himself to lie down in. That death made no sense at all. It was just like, okay, so now all of a sudden we have this unseen force where all these other deaths were kind of like people doing it to themselves. Like, I mean, the monk can't fly, but he's still compelling himself to fly. And then all of a sudden now we have this guillotine that slices this guy's head off.
You know, one thing that the, like right after his death, one of the reporters says, "Did he predict that one?" And it's like, come on, really, reporter?
Yeah.
It's a suicide. Of course he predicted it.
Of course, Mickey and Ryan aren't actually using their real names. So when their names are written to the journal by the Oracle of Death, or as I like to call him, Monk McDouchebag,
ascended upon by a tarantula, which Jack picks up and is like, oh, this cute little fella. And then they're trying to figure out later on, why weren't we killed? It's because they're not really who they say they are. Unlike Jack, though, is using his real name.
Exactly. And, like, right after, I think it's right after that scene, there's a moment where he's talking about, you know, check out, you know, call our Yorkshire office and see about the transfer. And he's playing with the rosary and the cross in his hands as if it's like a fidget spinner, which if he was truly a holy man, he would not be doing that with his rosary, and he would be treating his object of reverence with the honor that it deserves. So that's another clue, if you didn't catch that he was the bad guy of the episode, but that's another clue that he is just not who he says he is.
Another thing I wanted to point out is that the in terms of like who appears in what episodes, Roby appears in the most episodes of the whole series, but she does not actually appear in every single episode, as there are 72 episodes of the show, and she's only in 70 of them. Jack is only in 65, and then, of course, Ryan departs the show after season 2, so he's only in 54, and then Johnny shows up for the remaining 20 episodes.
Interesting, okay.
Yeah. Other characters do appear more than once, such as, obviously, Uncle Lewis, played by R.G. Armstrong. R.G. Armstrong played... I knew I recognized him, and I never put two and two together. He plays General Phillips in Predator.
Oh!
And he's Pruneface in the Dick Tracy movie.
That's him?
Yep.
Wow.
He's also the voice of the old man in the Millennium TV series, who's kind of the creepy guy giving out orders in to Jack Black or Frank Black, played by Lance Henriksen on that show.
Ah, interesting.
But he's also been in a number of television series such as Bonanza, Gunsmoke, The Perry Mason Show, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, China, Matlock, MacGyver, and many more. One of those character bit actors just happens to, you know, again, the show is going to be filled with these character bit actors, and we'll try to cover as many as we can, again, such as, you know, Sarah Polley, of course, who's the biggest one that I can think of so far in the two episodes that we've seen.
Now, we have to talk about the best lines in the entire episode, which Elise actually agrees with me on this one. He goes, I thought you were meditating. I was premeditating. Like, that's just like, oh, that's a pun that kind of hurts when you hear it. It's so good.
Ha 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 ha. By the way, also, I can't wait till we get to it. There's an episode directed by Cronenberg.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so by the way, Brother Simon and Tom, who are the two of the brothers that Mickey and Ryan are posing as, actually are killed by a tarantula someplace else.
Yes, in the actual Yorkshire Abbey.
Correct. There's one thing I didn't quite understand. So Jack gets captured and is about to be sliced with the guillotine by Brother McDouchebag. My question is, when he puts the candle there, doesn't Jack have enough slack to probably knock the candle over away from the rope? And by the way, how long does it take to burn through a rope? Because, man, is that sitting underneath that flame for quite some time?
I didn't quite time it to see how long it would last, because in television shows, timing is usually very off. A rope from a very old guillotine that's at least 100 to 150 years old, at least, that would be going up in a heartbeat, because that rope is probably pretty brittle as it was and very dry, unless it was a damp dungeon. Yeah, I would say a rope like that would probably only take a minute or 2 minutes to actually burn through.
Now, before we get to the worst part of this episode, which the flying guillotine is, let's talk about the MacGuffin of the episode and our spotlight of the cursed object. Did you ever happen to own a quilled pen?
No, I have not. I have never gotten into calligraphy, so therefore I have had not any reason to get a quill or fountain pen of any sort. I do, however, do those wax seals. So I love the wax seals, and I love melting wax and sealing my envelopes. But no, I've never actually owned a quill.
Is that all you like using wax for?
No, you know me. Wax on everything.
I just actually introduced my girlfriend. I have a girlfriend now. To the wonders of what wax can do, and that's all I will leave it at.
Make sure to oil up the skin first so the wax is easy to take off later.
You just completely spoiled it. It was supposed to be more implied, but okay.
This is what I do.
So, the worst thing about this episode is the guillotine that was supposed to slice off Jack's head starts flying around. And obviously, what's not CGI, because we didn't really have computer-generated imaging back then. I don't know. They must have shot the guillotine someplace else, flying around like a cartoon, and then like just spliced it into the film, the 35mm print.
Yeah, I think it was just a layered effect.
Yeah, or that too. Yeah.
Yeah, they, and so it's like they trick him into writing his own death sentence, pretty much, and it was a pretty cool little twist on what the quill actually does. But yeah, the flying blade of the guillotine was a little cheesy.
Now, Uncle Lewis sold all of these cursed antique objects, and the cousins sold all these cursed antique objects. Did they sell them to people that didn't live in whatever country they happened to be in? Did they go to Europe in other countries? Asia, Australia, Antarctica, Africa?
I'm sure the ones that were sold from Lewis ended up traveling with the owners wherever they went. And if you were actually killing people and knowingly killing people with your object, I'm sure you'd move around a lot too.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think that, like, you know, like the convenience of where these places are, the cousins and Jack keep running to. This is going to become like the murder capital of the world, next to the Lost Boys in Cabot Cove, Maine, where Jessica Fletcher lives from Murder, She Wrote.
You know, I often think, well, during the original run of this, like, if they don't sell anything, how are they keeping the lights on?
Yeah, that's the other thing I'm curious about. But don't forget, there's probably other antique objects there that aren't cursed. Is every single item cursed? It can't be, because, okay, so they inherit the store. Do they inherit the land? That does not mean, okay, that's fine, then they inherit the land too. That does not mean, though, that they inherit an electric bill and inherit a water bill.
Well, remember when you, in the last episode, the power and the water wasn't turned on yet.
Correct.
So they had been turned off, so someone would have to put their information with the power and the water company to turn those utilities back on. So who's footing the bill? And if they're not selling any objects out of this antique store, then how are they maintaining the bills? Yeah, it was just one of those, like, don't think about it, you know, parts of the show. Just magic.
Yeah, true. I don't know. I obviously need to suspend some of my disbelief over this show, otherwise I'm going to be thinking about it way too hard. And then, of course, Ryan's last line is, "Let's order something really sinful," as he takes the pen and about to write something down. And then they lunge at him like a, Brady Bunch moment.
Maybe they weren't exactly sure that was the real pen or not.
Yeah, maybe they should just, for good sake, just stick them both in the vault.
Yeah.
The one thing we didn't point out about the last episode is that they keep going in and out of the vault, so like certain cursed objects are going to make appearances and do things, and Vita does show up in several other episodes, and she does turn her head to look around and stuff. She's trapped in that vault because she is just a doll, so she can't like get up, walk around and stuff, but she does still has mobility of her head, so she will show up in future episodes when they put stuff in the vault.
Nice. Yeah, I read that in the book Curious Goods, and I'm looking forward to seeing some of those episodes.
Definitely. Well, that was the first two episodes of Friday the 13th, the TV series, and we thank you for joining us here on Friday the 13th of 2017. We are going to have these episodes of the Dead TV podcast out on every Friday now, every other Friday, so hopefully we will hit a Friday the 13th again in 2018. I do not believe there's another Friday the 13th in 2017, but I might be wrong. But we're going to be doing two episodes at a time, as we make our way through this amazing television show that me and Mr. Zeneca both absolutely adore.
Yes, I think the next Friday the 13th will be in April of 2018.
Okay, well, we will be actually probably just starting season 2 by then, because we will be taking a break between seasons 1 and 2 for another animated show.
Yes, just to break it up for you guys, you know, you can only handle so much Friday the 13th, and then we'll get right back to it.
Correct. And if you'd like to join us, please join us on Facebook at the Dead TV Podcast. You can also find this episode on either iTunes or on our website, radiohorror.com, or you can contact us through email, thatradioofhorror@gmail.com. Please send us an email if you like the episodes. Please leave us a bit of feedback on iTunes as well. That also helps us know that you love the episode. I do see the download bar jump up periodically on certain episodes here and there for the Dead TV Podcast on iTunes, which is always fun to see. And you can find us on our individual Twitters at ChrisDSAV.
And at Elegantly Kinky.
And I'd also like to thank Jessa Lantern for providing us with our theme song. And we'd like to thank our sponsor, Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts, for helping us out as well. And you can help us out on our Patreon, too, if you want to donate $1 to help us help offset some of the cost of storage for the episodes. I do pay for storage for the Dead TV Podcast, as well as the other podcast on the Radio of Horror Network, Supernatural Creatures and Lore. And thank you very much, and we'll be back in about 2 weeks or so. If just in case we hit a bump and it might be a little longer, we will post about it on Facebook. But we'd also like to thank any other website that happens to be now picking us up and carrying us to help us promote Friday the 13th, the TV series, on our podcast.
Well, a big thank you to our special guest, Elise Wax,
yes.
Author of Curious Goods.
Yes, and you can go to Bear Manor Media to pick up a copy of this book or order it from your local bookstore. Good night, everybody.
Good night.